Now, love and loneliness have been around since the creation of man. And long before eHarmony and Christian Mingle, folks had the Lonely Heart ads. When someone found themselves without love, they would simply place an ad in the Lonely Heart section of the local newspaper. And these advertisements were standard among the wanted ads, right next to odd jobs, puppies, and bicycles. One thing that definitely separated folks then from now is the fact that, for the most part, they were looking for marriage. They didn't waste precious time getting to know a person first. Unlike the folks on Tinder, you couldn't try the milk before you bought the cow. Often in the 18th and 19th centuries, these ads weren't placed out of a burning desire for love. Love was secondary to needing a helpmate. Help with raising children after a spouse died, physical labor, maintaining a household, or working a farm. Marriage was a necessity for women as well, oftentimes not being able to provide themselves with an income after their parents died. Here's an ad from 1901 that reads, "Seeking healthy lady, 30 to 35, to make a home on a ranch. Object, matrimony." Here's one from 1917. "I am a refined woman of good character, a good housekeeper, a cheerful disposition, which will make a good company for a man with money and good habits. Only those with matrimony in mind need apply." And another says, "I dare some lonely lady who would marry a congenial, ambitious bachelor to write me a letter. Weight 140, fine physique, nice looking, means of $2,000 with no one to look after." And it wasn't until later in the 20th century that these ads started to sound more romantically driven. Back then, just like today, financial stability was an important quality. And sometimes these companion seekers foolishly advertise their assets and wealth right there in the paper to make themselves seem more attractive. And here's an ad that says, "I am 30, wealthy, and own a large home. I sacrificed my youth to care for aging parents. Now I seek companionship." And while there were plenty of happy endings to these stories, unfortunately, as always, when the opportunity arises, good-for-nothing son of a guns slither out from the woodwork to prey on these vulnerable individuals who laid it all on the line for love. And today, the ladies are going to tell you about two of the worst.
Is it a sin? Is it a crime? Loving you dear like I do. If it's a crime, then I'm guilty, guilty of loving you. Maybe I'm wrong, dreaming of you, dreaming the lonely night through. If it's a crime, then I'm guilty, guilty of dreaming of.
The sources for today's episode are going to be listed on our website and on the show notes. Just a warning, it might be a little graphic today, so you might not want to listen with your kids or anybody who's sensitive. My name's Darlene.
And I'm Melody.
This is Hard Times and True Crimes. So I'm going to introduce you to a man named Raymond Fernandez. He made up one half of the Lonely Hearts Killers. He was born December 17th in 1914 in Hawaii to his parents who were Spanish immigrants. Later, the family would move to California, then to Connecticut. Raymond's dad was a handyman and a farmer. According to Raymond, he was especially hateful to him. He wouldn't let him go to school as he got older. He'd make him do more demeaning chores. I'm not sure what that humiliating work was, but he felt victimized by it. When Fernandez was 16, he and some friends decided it would be a good idea to steal two chickens. And this was the 30s, and so they enforced harsher consequences, even with petty crime. His friends' families, who had stolen the chickens with him, they bailed their kids out. His father would not pay his way out. And he ended up doing 6 months for being a part of that.
For stealing 2 chickens?
Yes.
Maybe the price of eggs had gone way up.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that. You know, I've always told my kids that if you commit a crime, you can be prepared to pay those consequences. But that does seem like an especially long time.
Yeah.
But those were different times. After he was let out, Raymond would move away from his family. He really wanted to get out from under his oppressive father. So he moved to Spain, where he worked on his uncle's farm. As he became a man, he would be known as smart, easygoing, super nice. He was just really good with people. Fernandez seemed to have a way of drawing people in, and especially women. He had a way with the ladies.
He was a ladies' man.
He was a great conversationalist who could make you feel like you were the only person in the room.
Yeah, and women love that.
Oh, yeah. When he was 20, he fell in love and he married a woman that he called Encarnacion. I'm probably not saying that right. I always think about, have you ever seen Jack Black in Nacho Libre?
Yes.
So yeah, I'm thinking about that nun.
Now I'm saying that name in my head in Jack Black's voice.
Yes. So she and Raymond would have 4 kids together. So she was not a nun, but they were in love in those early days. After the birth of their first child, he would go to the U.S. to work and make money for his family. But he quickly returned to Spain when he got word from his wife that their son was sick. Now, he did want to go back to the U.S. as soon as he could because there were better opportunities there. But life and World War II happened. During World War II, Fernandez served as a merchant marine for Spain, and then he went on to serve in the British intelligence for 2 years. So he was a spy.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. So he was smart.
Yeah. Pretty impressive. After the war, 12 years after the last time he'd gone to the U.S., he decided to go back. His plan was to bring his family over as soon as he could save enough money. While on the U.S. bound ship, a steel hatch fell on his head and severely damaged his skull's frontal lobe.
That sounds familiar.
Anyone who listened to the Lawson family episode can remember the dad also had a frontal lobe injury, we think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he murdered his family.
So it's interesting to see what this is going to do for Raymond.
Well, I always knew that concussions and serious hits on the head could cause drastic personality changes, but I did look up the symptoms this time from various resources. Here are a few things that can cause: impatience, impulsive, dangerous behaviors, verbal and physical outbursts, poor judgment, negativity, rigidity, egocentricity, and odd sexual habits.
That's an interesting list.
It is. And you know, several serial killers have been known to have had hits on the head.
I did not know that, but I can see I'm going to be taking a deep dive because I know you've already done a story similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
And my curiosity is really up.
So Fernandez was a different man, both outward and inward. He was left with scars on his head and with patches of hair missing, which he was very self-conscious about. Where he'd been easygoing and super friendly before, he would become easily agitated, moody, and he seemed to have this grandiose sense of self, and you'll see what I mean later on. I do believe that impulse control became an issue for him. For one thing, he started stealing. And it's interesting because he had, you know, been caught stealing before when he was 16, so I'm not sure if he had already had a propensity for theft and had just managed to control it before, or maybe that early incident was just a stupid mistake that he'd made showing off with his friends.
Yeah.
As far as we know, he hadn't committed any crimes from the time he was 16 until after that head injury.
Okay.
Was it the head injury or was Fernandez just a common thief? In 1946, he was working on a ship that was headed to Mobile, Alabama. And while on that ship, he decided to help himself to a bunch of linens. He stole clothes and anything else that he thought he could inconspicuously carry out. But he wasn't as slick as he thought he was. And as soon as he went through customs, they found it. He was arrested and given a year-long sentence in the Tallahassee, Florida federal prison.
Okay.
Supposedly, his cellmate was a Haitian man who practiced voodoo, and Fernandez became obsessed with this dark magic. He read anything and everything he could get his hands on to learn more about it, and he had a cellmate teach him everything that he knew. Remember how I mentioned that after that head injury, he acquired this grandiose sense of self?
Mm-hmm.
He believed that these voodoo practices made him irresistible to women, and this gave him an idea for a con.
Okay, I'm curious right here. Was he a good-looking man?
I think he, like, had swagger.
Ah, oh, he has a little swag.
You know, and he would later on start wearing a toupee. And I think with that toupee, he was. Without, not so much.
Okay, and so I'm sure it gave him confidence.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and I'm also wondering, are his wife and children still back in Spain?
They are still back in Spain.
So he's married, they're still there, and he's in the U.S. living as a single man, I'm guessing.
Yes. And if you remember, he was supposed to go back and get them.
But he didn't.
He never did. Oh. He abandoned them.
Okay.
He believed that, according to what he'd heard, that he could actually hypnotize women from far away. This is a little bit PG-13, but he actually believed he could have sex with women from far away.
Like, by their mind, like hypnotizing them?
I guess. I have no idea.
That is weird.
But yeah.
Women, be careful who you get mixed up with.
Please.
Especially now in the day of social media where you can just meet people online. Like, you might be meeting people like that guy.
Well, yeah. He tried it out on the judge. Well, not the sex part. Wait, <what? laughs> not that part. But he tried a voodoo spell on the judge who had sentenced him to that year in prison. And Fernandez was convinced that these powers worked because the judge released him early.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I read somewhere that it was like a gambler who on their first gambling trip won $1,000 and they were just hooked.
They're hooked.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I've got this. I'm going to go with it now. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Once he got out of prison, he was ready to get to work on that scheme.
This is hilarious.
He bought himself that toupee
mm-hmm.
to cover up his scars and his bald spots. He came up with an alter ego, a name for himself, a wealthy, suave, yeah, business gentleman.
Sorry, I know that was suave. I mean, over here in America, we would say suave, but in Spain, it would be suave because you probably don't remember this.
Rico suave.
I remember. So as soon as you said it, I'm like, oh, Rico Suave.
Yes. Well, okay.
He's yeah. Rico Suave. Got it.
He is. He called himself Charles Martin, and he moved to Brooklyn, New York with his sister. Now, she would later say that when he came to live with her, he would lock himself in his room nearly all the time, saying that he had headaches and complaining of not feeling well. His sister, you know, she was worried about him. But in reality, he was spending all that time poring over Lonely Hearts advertisement.
Okay.
Looking for vulnerable, wealthy women who he could con. Okay, I feel like I should say, because I'm going to be referring to him as Charles Martin sometimes, Fernandez sometimes, and also Raymond sometimes. Those are all the same person. All
right. Raymond Fernandez, Charles Martin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Got it.
Raymond had a talent for writing long romantic love letters. He should have become a novelist instead. But he prided himself on how easy it was for him to fool these women into thinking he was in love with them and that he was wealthy and lonely and ready to settle down and get married. And of course, he convinced each of them that they were the ones that he wanted to settle down with.
Mm-hmm.
Raymond seemed like an answer to their prayers. He would ask them to send him pictures of themselves and a lock of their hair. They would just think this was such a romantic gesture, but in reality, he was performing a voodoo love spell
my goodness.
On these women to make them fall in love with him and to make him irresistible.
He's creepy.
Yes. After he had gained their trust, he would convince these unsuspecting women to give him money, jewelry, and some even signed over their assets because they believed that he was going to be their husband. And in that era, it wasn't uncommon for the husband to have complete control over household finances. In 1947, Raymond met a woman named Jane Thompson. She was separated at the time from her husband, and she lived in an apartment on the Upper West Side of New York City with her mother. Jane fell hard for Raymond. She was probably considered plain. I wouldn't imagine that she got a ton of male attention. Not because she wasn't a great person. I don't think she would have stood out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Raymond Fernandez, or Charles, as she knew him, was dark, handsome, as long as he kept his toupee on. He wore three-piece suits and a fedora.
Oh, he did have swagger.
Yeah. So the attention from this man must have been like exhilarating.
I'm sure. And all those letters and stuff. Women love that. We do.
Yes. And he was really good at it. He doted on her, poured out his heart, shared his dreams with her. He listened. He was affectionate. He was a shark. And yeah. She was his prey.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. And before long, he asked her to marry him. She moved him into her New York apartment and paid for the two of them to go to Spain on their honeymoon.
Mm-hmm. He's going back to Spain where his wife and kids are?
Okay, so he actually introduced her
what?
To his wife and
Wait.
Kids.
Wait!
They went out to dinner.
Okay, so he did his wife know that this was...
I don't know.
That is straight
up crazy.
The wife
back in Spain, because now he has two wives.
Oh my goodness. I wonder if did he say, is this my ex-wife? This is...
I don't know.
That's weird.
It really is. Okay. So yeah, they were all seen out together in town multiple times. And it sounds like wife number one got along great with wife number two. He had not divorced his Spanish wife. Jane and Raymond stayed in nice hotels while they were there, ate fancy dinners, went on countryside tours of Spain, all on her dime, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, they had an argument in public. The next morning, Jane was found dead in her hotel room.
Oh, I did not see that coming. Mm-hmm. Like, I know some of this story, but I do not remember that. I did not see that coming. Okay.
Now, authorities assumed she died from natural causes. There were no marks on her that insinuated that she'd been murdered. They didn't do an autopsy. Later, though, they did suspect she'd been poisoned, but honestly, I don't even know still what came of that. Okay. I don't know that they've ever proved that. I mean, I think they know.
Yeah.
But they don't know.
Yeah. All right. I have a theory.
Okay.
I think his first wife, the one in Spain, I think she had to know.
Yeah.
I think he had to have told her, I'm going to introduce you. I don't know. It's my sister or something.
Right.
I think she was in on that. And he probably told her he was going to kill this lady and get them some money or something. I think she had to know.
I wonder if he wasn't sending her money this whole time.
Maybe so. And yeah. Then, you know, she needs the support. She's got four kids, right?
Right. He very quickly skipped town and headed back to New York to take over Jane's apartment.
Hmm.
Yeah. He had convinced her to sign over her apartment and everything she owned to him. That or he forged the will.
Yeah.
You know, we'll never know. But either way, he wound up with everything. And he actually went back and kicked her elderly mother out of that apartment, informing her, you know, her daughter had died and been killed in a bus accident, he told her.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And he forced her out?
Yep.
That's horrible.
So now he had this nice New York apartment, and that would lend credibility to his guys as a wealthy bachelor.
Exactly. Yeah, it's going to add to his swagger a little bit. Yep.
The whole time he'd been conning Jane, he was still corresponding with multiple other women. Born in Milton, Florida, May 6, 1920, Martha Jane Seabrook was the youngest of five children. Her siblings would later say that as the youngest, she was a little bit spoiled. But Martha says she was victimized. She had a glandular disorder. Now, this is true, and I did feel bad for her about this, because it caused her to be, she was overweight from a very young age.
Okay.
Because of this. And she also, from the time she was like 10 years old, had already gone through complete puberty.
Mm.
She was made fun of a lot by her classmates for her weight. She said that her mother ridiculed her for her weight and the way she looked.
Oh, that is sad.
Later, when she did go to trial, she said as a child, she was raped by her older brother. When she told her mother about it, that her mom beat and blamed her.
Oh, that's awful too. Doesn't that just seem like a common thread in almost all of these stories that we do, that along with that murder, somebody has been sexually assaulted or molested or something?
Right.
Isn't that just so sad?
Yeah. It all goes back to that nature versus nurture
thing.
Are criminals born or are they made?
Mm-hmm.
Her mother was smothering, for sure. After she found out about the rape, Martha said she would not get her out of her sight.
Mm.
She couldn't have friends. She couldn't have boyfriends. She couldn't have a social life. It was a lot.
And so what, this son, just nothing happened? He got away with that and never got blamed? That's horrible.
Yeah. Despite all of this, though, Martha, she was a really good student, and she excelled in school. After she graduated from high school, she was accepted into nursing school in Pensacola. In 1942, she graduated first in her nursing class. She was a qualified and capable nurse, but because of her weight and the way that she looked, she could not get a job.
Oh, so discrimination for that even back then, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Definitely.
Maybe even more so.
Yeah.
But it was not as common back then. Mm-hmm. So
there was no body positivity back in the
right.
40s for sure.
Yeah.
So we weren't celebrating all shapes.
Right.
So that, you know, that's sad.
Yeah.
Finally, though, she did find work at a funeral home assisting the mortician. She helped prepare the female bodies for burial. Now, she ended up later quitting that job in order to get away from her mom. She ended up moving to work at an army hospital in California. She was finally free from her overbearing mom, and she had a job that she loved. The only thing that was missing from her life was love itself, and Martha would immediately start looking for it in all the wrong places. She spent her evenings after work hanging out at like beer joints, looking to meet good looking soldiers. And she did meet a few, but they were looking for something, but it wasn't love.
Yeah.
Soon Martha began to engage in a lot of casual sex. And during this time, and unsurprisingly, she wound up pregnant.
Right.
She wasn't really upset about it, though, because, you know, she figured that her and the father of her baby would get married. So she called him over and told him about the pregnancy. He did not ask her to marry him. Instead, he tried to commit suicide by jumping off of a bridge.
Wow. Tried to commit suicide over it, huh?
What a gut punch. He'd rather be dead
than to be a father to the child that he has already fathered.
Yeah. Or to marry her.
Yeah.
You know, that's horrible. Rejection at its finest.
At its peak. That's horrible.
What a jerk, right?
Mm-hmm.
She was good enough to sleep with, but, you know, anyway.
Not good enough to marry.
Exactly. He didn't die in the attempted suicide, but she never saw him again or never even tried.
I don't blame her.
So Martha, feeling rejected, depressed, alone, with a baby on the way, didn't have many options. So she went back home to Florida. She was too ashamed to tell her family what had happened, the truth. So she made up this elaborate lie that she was married to a serviceman who was serving in the Pacific, but he was going to come home on furlough for the birth of their baby. A few weeks before he was supposed to arrive, Martha wrote up and had sent to her this letter saying that her husband had been killed in action.
You know, as a single mom, she had to protect her, I guess, her reputation.
Right.
And back then, that would have been a big shameful thing.
It would have.
And so now she's a single mom because she's a widow, per se.
Right.
Yeah.
And her family and the entire town, they really did rally around her. I mean, they were heartbroken for this pregnant widow. Mm-hmm. Who had lost her husband. And the local newspaper even wrote up an article about Martha and that tragedy.
Wow. So she did find a way to save face over that.
She did. And then she had her little girl and she named her Willa Dean.
Oh, that's cute.
I thought so too. Very shortly after, she met a bus driver in Pensacola named Alfred Beck. It wasn't long before she was pregnant again. And he did marry her, but the marriage would only last 6 months. Martha kept his last name, but it was over between the two of them. They were not compatible, I guess.
It's that same pattern of choosing the wrong men over and over again. We've also seen that in a lot of the stories recorded and stuff.
Oh, yeah. So during that time, she had also lost her job, maybe even because of the divorce.
Yeah.
This was a different time.
Right,
so.
Possibly so, yeah.
Then she gives birth to a little boy named Anthony. She's unemployed, lonely, divorced, and now a mother of two. And you'd think maybe this would spur her, you know, to get her act together, focus on her children, or at least getting a job.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, Martha became obsessed with romance novels and movies like Gaslight and Confidential Agent.
Mm.
She was constantly fantasizing about love.
Yeah. Well, and I feel bad for her because she's been rejected in the worst of ways her whole life.
Yeah.
She has faced rejection after rejection after rejection.
She has.
So she's kind of, you know, I think the movies and the romance novels, that's just a fantasy escape.
Right.
That's what that is.
This may come across as judgy, but, you know, when I see single moms who cannot focus on their children because of their burning desire for a man, and it breaks my heart because their children crave and need their mother's love and attention just as much or more as that mother needs romance. And there's a time for that, you know, let it happen organically.
Yeah, exactly.
Or let the Lord bring someone into your life.
Yeah, we see that all the time in real life.
And that time is so short.
Mm-hmm.
And so many women forfeit that sweet time with their children to manhunt.
And then they make bad decisions on the men that they choose. usually to the detriment of the children.
Often these children grow up looking for the love that they missed out on mm-hmm. as kids, and it becomes a cycle.
Yeah, looking in the same places for the in the same way. Yeah, it right. is sad.
It is, but I digress. So
I know, I got us off on a rabbit trail when I brought that up.
But anyway, in 1946, Martha got a job at a children's hospital in Pensacola, and she was a really good nurse. Later, she would write, "I chose this profession without thought of self and wanted to prepare myself for this profession, not for material gains, but for the purpose of aiding humanity and rendering service to others."
Okay.
Yeah. Her personal life was a disaster, but she was killing it at work.
Is there a pun in there, Darlene? Just wondering.
But so, yeah, before long, she was head nurse and superintendent.
Okay.
During this time, though, one of her coworkers, kind of as a cruel joke, had this request sent to her house, a Lonely Hearts ad, a request to join.
Yeah.
And at first, it like hurt her feelings, but then she decided, you know what? I'm gonna do it.
Yeah.
I'm gonna place the ad. And so she did, and she actually became excited about it and was kind of desperately like waiting for a reply.
I'm thinking, when life gives you lemons. So she turned that into a positive for herself.
Yes. And then in December of 1947, she finally got a reply from Raymond Fernandez, a.k.a. Charles Martin from New York City.
Mm-mm-mm.
And he sounded like a dream. He told her that he was a wealthy businessman from Spain. He explained how lonely he was and how his apartment was too big for just him, but he had hoped to share it soon with a wife. Raymond wrote that he knew that she was a nurse, and he chose to write her because, quote, he knew that she had a full heart with a great capacity for comfort and love, unquote.
Wow, he's just a regular Cyrano de Bergerac.
Mm-hmm. In reality, he thought she had a pocketbook full of money from her nursing career. And a lot of times women who were divorced, they owned houses, they had assets. He didn't care what she had as long as it was something he could get.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked her for that lock of her hair and that picture. She was too embarrassed to actually send him a picture. She said that a picture wouldn't do her justice. But she did send a lock of her hair spritzed with some perfume. And she loved that he had asked her for a lock of hair. She just thought that was so creatively charming.
She probably thought, oh, how romantic.
Yes, she did. And she lived for those letters. He was throwing on that charm, and Martha was buying all the junk he was selling, for sure. She'd still not told him about her two kids, and he had no idea about her size, which at that time was about 250 pounds. But he could have cared less how big she was.
He was looking for the size of her pocketbook.
Exactly. He figured that she'd have a house, a car, maybe a little money. Nurses usually made a pretty good living. In return, she would get to spend some time with him. And alleviated any guilt he might have had.
He's like, oh, this one lucky woman.
He literally would say that later.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, he felt like it was a good trade.
He is full of himself.
In December of 1947, he took a train to Pensacola to meet Martha. I'm sure she was terrified that he might get right back on that train after he saw her, but he didn't. In fact, if he was surprised, he didn't show it at all. And Martha thought that he was gorgeous.
So she hit the jackpot with him, or so she thought.
Yeah, so she thought. He was dark and handsome, and she just couldn't believe that he was interested in her. She brought him back to her apartment to meet her kids. They ate dinner together and turned up the heat on the charm. He did.
Mm-hmm.
He spent actually a couple of weeks with her, making her believe that he wanted to marry her, just being real good to her kids. And Martha felt like she was in heaven. It didn't take Fernandez too long, though, to realize she didn't really have much to be conned out of. And so he made an excuse, like saying he had business back in New York that he needed to attend to. But he promised her that he would send money for her and the kids to move with him and that they were going to get married. And Martha was ecstatic. She told everyone this exciting news. Everybody was really happy for her because they had never seen her this happy before. So her friends and her family threw her a wedding shower. But literally the day of that shower, he wrote her a letter telling her that she'd misunderstood his intentions. He couldn't marry her, that he had a wife back in Spain.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, Raymond. Yeah.
She was devastated.
Yeah.
And she was humiliated, of course.
Sure, yeah.
So she tried to take her own life that night. Aww. And her kids.
Oh.
She tried to gas them.
Oh, that's horrible.
But thankfully, a neighbor saved her life. And that neighbor wrote a letter to Raymond telling him what had happened. And,
like,
you know,
probably just calling him out for it.
Yeah, just how he devastated her and how much she loved him. But, well, and the reason the neighbor even knew about this was because she had found a suicide note written by Martha.
So that was a good neighbor.
Yes. He must have had some twinge of guilt because he actually called and asked her to come and visit him in New York. He's terrible. But then that really did bother him.
Okay. That's, yeah, interesting.
You know, she had just had a really good time. But when she came back to Pensacola, she was fired from her job. Now, she says she was fired because they found out about her rendezvous, like they were racist. But I do not believe that. You know, you can't just leave your job
for 2 weeks
and go hang out with a guy.
Yeah.
So I feel like that was probably what happened. But anyway, she packed her bags for her and her kids, picked up her last check, and the check was made out to Martha Fernandez.
I wonder why. I mean, they didn't get married.
No. I guess she thought that they were going to.
And so she had already changed her name or told them at work?
I guess so.
Oh, that's interesting.
Her and the kids showed up on his doorstep, and that was not in his plans.
Uh-oh.
He was running cons on women.
Yeah.
And how in the world could he keep that up with...
That's going to put a damper on things.
Yeah. With two kids and a woman there, he just couldn't allow that.
Well, with his con artist brain, I'm sure he'll come up with a solution.
Right. And actually, she took pretty good care of him. She cleaned his apartment.
It wasn't all bad. It
wasn't all bad. So he actually decided that she could stay, but her kids could not.
Please tell me she does not take that deal, that she does not ship her kids off somewhere.
On January 25th, 1947, Martha took her kids to the YMCA and abandoned them there.
Oh, good grief. That is horrible. Well, I was feeling sorry for her up until that point.
Yeah.
Now I have no pity for her.
Oh, yeah. She's a piece of work.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know you've been rejected your whole life, but nope.
No, that's terrible.
And it's all for some guy.
Mm-hmm. Her choosing him over even her own kids proved to him that she was loyal.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt like he could trust her. And so he just started opening up to her about the Lonely Heart scam that he was running and about his plans to seduce and con other women. And to his surprise, Martha wasn't shocked or uncomfortable. Like,
oh, she's on board.
Most normal people would
be. Right,
right. In fact, she thought it sounded pretty thrilling. And without her kids or a job to hold her back, you know, hey, she wanted in. She agreed that he could fool around with these women. When I say fool around, like, he could pretend that he loved them. And he could even marry them for their money. But she did not want him consummating any of those relationships.
So in her mind, they are a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And in his mind, he at some point, he's going along with it with her.
Yeah.
So does he, at some point, he fell in love with her?
I do believe he loved her.
Okay.
In a weird, sick, twisted way. I think a lot of it was his ego because she tried to commit suicide several times when she was with him, like over jealousy and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And that stroked his ego.
It did. And it seemed to like almost draw him closer to her.
Bunch of dysfunction.
A bunch of dysfunction, yeah. He agreed. And so together they started scouring those Lonely Hearts ads to find their next victims. And it didn't take them long. They settled on a woman named Esther Hinn from Pennsylvania. Now, Raymond started writing his famous love letters, and poor Esther, she was swept right off of her feet. Martha and Charles made the drive to her home, and Martha pretended that she was Charles's sister.
Yeah.
So, Esther...
Sorry, I was going to say, I do remember that detail about the story.
And it's funny, because they look nothing alike.
Yeah.
Like, he's Spanish.
Right.
And she's definitely not, but I don't know, people fell for it. Esther and Martha got along great. Everything came together. Esther was head over heels. And a week later, on February 28th, 1948, she and Charles were married in a little ceremony at the Fairfax, Virginia courthouse.
Okay, so he's married again.
He's married again. And for a few days, he was really good to Esther. But when she wouldn't sign over her teacher's pension or her insurance policies, he wasn't so nice anymore.
Mm.
Esther, she got suspicious over that. She heard a neighbor saying that Raymond had traveled to Spain with a woman who had had that apartment before, and she had suddenly died. So in a smart move, she cut her losses and she left.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And Raymond stole her vehicle, of course, and hundreds of dollars, but she had her life.
Yeah.
So she was too embarrassed by the whole ordeal to report him. You know, women who wrote to those ads, they were stereotyped as being desperate or looking for sexual encounters. And in reality, most of these women were lonely.
Lonely.
And they were searching for true love, really. Right.
I mean, the Lonely Hearts Club really does say it all.
Yeah.
That appealed to them.
Raymond knew these women were less likely to report him, too. When Raymond and Martha realized they weren't getting anything more from Esther, they quickly moved on to another lady that he had been writing named Myrtle Young, whom Charles had been conversing with from Green Forest, Arkansas. In August of 1948, Raymond would marry her in Cook County, Illinois. Of course, his loving sister was always around, and this was starting to annoy Myrtle. She liked her at first, but she wanted time alone with her new husband. She probably wanted to do what married folks do in private.
Yeah, and you might say this later. I don't want to jump the gun, but I do remember when I read that about that case. That she, since she was posing as the sister, she was kind of like the chaperone because it wasn't, you know, appropriate for them to be alone together. And so she was kind of like the chaperone.
Exactly.
So once they're married.
But they're married.
They don't want to chaperone, or she doesn't want to chaperone anymore. The sister might be like getting in the way.
Right. I mean, this was even to the point of she was sleeping in the same bed with them.
Oh, wait, what? Well, she, Martha's going to make sure he does not consummate.
Myrtle was getting weirded out. But Ray started to worry that Myrtle might leave before he could get everything he wanted from her like Esther had done.
Right.
So he had Martha feed her a bunch of sleeping pills. And when she was unconscious, Martha helped him get her on a bus bound for Little Rock, Arkansas. Yeah. And when that bus reached its destination, Myrtle had to be physically carried off the bus and taken to the hospital. And she died the next day.
Oh, wow.
Now, I don't really think that they meant to murder her.
That's what I was wondering.
I don't even know if they knew what happened until way later.
Okay.
They had her out of the way.
Did they get anything from her?
$4,000.
Oh.
So Raymond and Martha looked high and low. They didn't waste any time. They were looking high and low for more victims, and they found a lot of them. Sister Martha, always by her brother's side. Some of these women, they weren't as wealthy in terms of assets, but they did manage to steal smaller amounts of cash and jewelry. Mm-hmm. Others they found were too young and pretty for Martha's liking.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
And she was not having that. She was actually very jealous. The women needed to be older and or what Martha considered unattractive.
Okay. And those are the ones would probably easier to fool because they're.
So they finally agreed on a victim by the name of Janet Fay, and she was 66 years old. He was in his 30s.
Oh, that I'm already feeling bad for her. I know.
So she was a 66-year-old widow from Albany, New York. She had a big New York apartment, plenty of money in the bank. And she was very lonely. So Ray pulled out that pen and paper and he began the wooing process. She sent a lock of her hair. He performed that ritual. And in Ray's mind, it was a done deal. She was locked in. And she wouldn't be able to resist him. Janet was thrilled over her new budding relationship. She was a devout Catholic. And so Charles would write long, beautiful letters about his deep convictions and faith. Janet grew to trust him. When he showed up on her doorstep with a bouquet of flowers and his sister by his side as their chaperone so that no one would question her integrity, she was convinced of his pure intentions. And she was so grateful to Martha that she would come. Janet and Raymond would have long, deep theological conversations. He just really drew her in. When he asked for her hand in marriage, there was no hesitation. It hadn't been a long courtship, but she knew that this was love. Raymond convinced Janet to move to Long Island, where the three of them could rent out an apartment together. He convinced her before they went to Long Island to take all of her money out of her accounts. He promised to keep the money safe, of course. And so Janet was starry-eyed. It never even crossed her mind that this could be a ruse. They would arrive at the apartment on January 4th, 1949. They all sat down and had a nice meal together. They got ready for bed, but at some point, Martha walked in on Janet without any clothes on and with her arms around Raymond.
Uh-oh.
which would have been perfectly normal for a newlywed couple. Yes. But after Ray fell asleep, Janet and Martha were left alone together. Nobody knows for sure exactly what happened because Martha told a couple of different stories and so did Raymond. But she did consistently say that seeing Janet and Raymond together sent her into a rage. She said that she'd already been mad because she felt like he was ignoring her and getting too close to Janet. Martha said, and this is a quote, "I was just burning up with jealousy and anger." But some kind of loud argument broke out and Raymond woke up and he was freaking out, worried about the neighbors.
Oh, right.
I do know that there was a suitcase right there.
Okay.
So I kind of wonder if she was actually getting ready to leave.
Oh, maybe.
They never admitted this.
Either way, I know it's not going to end well.
Oh, no, it's not. He told Martha to shut her up. He went into the bathroom. Martha would say that she blacked out. And the next thing she knew, Raymond had her by the shoulders, shaking her, asking her what she had done. Janet's body was laying on the floor with blood pouring from her head. Martha later said she could still hear the dripping of Janet's blood dripping from her head into the floor. Martha had bludgeoned her in the head with a ball peen hammer. Remember, they gave several stories, but just kind of keep this in mind.
Okay.
So he later said that he had to finish it, so he strangled her to death with a scarf, using the hammer as the garrote.
Okay, to tighten it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They cleaned up the blood and put her body in a big trunk. They asked Ray's sister if they could keep the trunk and some other things in her basement.
Oh, yeah. I forgot he actually did have a sister.
Yeah. And she didn't think anything of it, so she was like, sure. And a couple of weeks later, they picked it up and buried it in a basement of a house that they were renting. Then Raymond just poured cement over her, you know, over the grave.
Yeah, I remember that part, too.
Ray and Martha were so tore up over this unintentional death that they cashed her checks and typed up a bunch of letters.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Say that tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
This is the letter that they sent to Janet Faye's family. "My dearest Mary, you may think I am mean by not writing to you sooner. Please excuse me. I've been so busy going and seeing so many different places and doing so much shopping. I'm all excited and having the most wonderful time of my life. I never felt as happy as before. I will soon be Mrs. Martin, and then we will go to Florida for the winter. Mary, I'm about to ask you something, a great favor. I would like you to call the American Express agency and have them ship my trunk and boxes that I have left there. The address is on the various stickers. I'm enclosing this in the letter." Anyway, there's more to it, but you get the gist of it. Her family did not buy that.
Good.
They said, first of all, she didn't own a typewriter, nor did she even really know her way around one. It'd be like my great-grandma using Twitter or something.
Right.
They just knew those letters were not from her, and they immediately called police and reported her missing.
Oh, good. And probably that, like, the wording of it probably didn't sound like something she would say, because I'm like, how would they? I don't know. That just seemed, I think I would be suspicious of that.
Right. And I'm give them credit for...
Yes.
Because so many people, they're like, well, maybe I'm just over it. Maybe I'm just overthinking it, or...
I typically am like that. Like, I don't want to overreact, and that's probably nothing. It's really actually good to think, oh, well, if I'm suspicious, maybe I better report it.
Right.
Yeah.
Because what's it going to hurt?
Good for them.
Yes. And then Ray and Martha headed west to Grand Rapids, Michigan, where their next victim was waiting. Delphine Downing was a 31-year-old widow who had secretly placed a Lonely Hearts ad. She felt guilty about it, embarrassed. Her life was not supposed to go this way. She hadn't imagined loneliness in her future. In 1942, Delphine traveled from her hometown in Nebraska to visit one of her three sisters in Los Angeles, California. And while she was there, she met a handsome GI named Roland Downing. He was still serving, but they had an exciting few days together. They exchanged love letters for the next 2 years. In 1944, Roland came home on leave and he married Delphine. After the war, he moved his new wife to his hometown in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That's where she is now.
Okay.
Or where she was at this time. And life was good for them. They were happy together. They were very in love. And soon they welcomed a beautiful baby girl and they named her Raynell. I love that.
Yeah, that's pretty.
But in November of 1947, When Raynell was just 5 months old, Roland's work truck was hit by a train. He was thrown 90 feet from the vehicle and killed instantly, leaving Delphine a widow.
Mm-hmm.
She was devastated. She had stayed really close to her father-in-law, and she had told him, I'm never getting married again. And she never thought she would. But, you know, there she was 2 years later, missing companionship.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not wanting her daughter to miss out on having a father. She was living 1,000 miles away from her family. So you can see why she might have placed that ad.
Right.
Delphine had a few replies, but none interested her. She was looking for a certain type, husband and father material. Then she got a letter from the sweetest of gentlemen, a handsome businessman named Charles Martin.
Who had a way with words.
Mm-hmm. Who desperately wanted children of his own, but he never had been married. But of course he wanted to be. she was pretty.
Mm-hmm. And she was young too, right?
Right. So I'm really surprised that
Martha
allowed that.
Yeah.
Delphine believed this Charles was everything she had been looking for. She found herself smiling and dreaming again. Happiness seemed possible for the first time in 2 years. In January of 1949, Mr. Charles Martin arrived with his sister for a visit to meet Delphine and her little girl. Raymond was dark-skinned, dressed to kill, in his fedora in one hand and flowers in the other. He made quite the first impression. But after seeing him with Raynell, he would get down and play with her. He bought her little things. He made her laugh. He even referred to himself as Raynell's New York daddy.
Oh.
Delphine's heart melted. Before the month was out, he and Delphine were married in a private ceremony, and they had become intimate.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, when Martha finds out, that's not going to go well.
Mm-mm.
Also, I can't help but think, she married him very quickly when she thought she wouldn't marry again. We've said it before, I know, but when you're in that early stage of falling in love with somebody, you don't see the red flags.
Mm-mm.
You don't see their faults. We turn a blind eye.
Yeah.
Not that some quick engagements don't work out. I know many that have.
Sure.
Yours did.
Mine.
Okay.
Yeah. 2 months.
Okay. But maybe not always the wisest decision to choose somebody that quickly until you get to know them.
Right.
And so I feel bad for her already because she was lonely.
She was.
Yeah.
I really kind of go into a lot of depth in this one because it just, it's heartbreaking. They're all heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But Ray got to work. You know, he started talking Delphine into liquidating her assets, into selling her home. She would get $4,500 out of it. He was added to her bank account, and the new buyers would take over the house March 1st. Delphine and Raynell would move with Ray and his sister, Martha, to California. He later claimed that he actually had really fallen for Delphine, that he had meant to take her and Raynell with him, but that he could not get rid of Martha.
Oh, that's a little twist there. So now his feelings have changed a little bit.
Mm-hmm. He said,
he can't shake her loose.
He said she was always around. He even at one point offered to give Martha a car and a large sum of money just to go away, but she wasn't going anywhere. He seemed like he could not say no to her.
Yeah, it's weird. They have a weird relationship.
Yeah. So Delphine, Raynell, Ray, and Martha, they went all the way to Nebraska to introduce, you know, her husband to her family. She didn't want her family to know how they really met, though. And so she made up a story that Martha had been her nurse when she had Raynell, mm-hmm. and that they had stayed in touch and become best friends, and then introduced her to her brother, knowing that she was lonely.
Yeah.
So you can see, she was ashamed of the way
she
met him.
Yeah, there was a little stigma with that, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
And her family, they knew how lonely and just how hard life had been for her. They were impressed with her new husband. He was mild-mannered, financially stable. He was a businessman who not only loved Delphine, but Raynell as well. He would get down on the floor. He would say, "Give Daddy a kiss, Raynell." Yeah, he was just throwing it on thick.
That idea, that's disturbing me so much.
Yeah, they had her family's blessing. They stayed 2 weeks with them. So he had to have been a charmer.
Right, because, I mean, that's what I was getting ready to say. If he got the family's blessing, he was good at knowing what to say. And, like, that's what con artists do. That's why they're cons, right? They know how to work people.
You know, a lot of these con artists, they would almost want to keep these women secluded so that the family wouldn't know anything about.
Right.
He was so confident that he would
like to meet your family
out there. Yeah, always. Delphine also introduced Raymond and Martha to her neighbors. She was best friends with her neighbors. They were really like family, especially since her husband had passed. She would babysit for them like 5 days a week. She ate dinner with them several nights a week, visited, you know, just to talk. They were friends.
Mm-hmm.
They shopped together, and any repairs or maintenance that she would have depended on her husband for, they kept up for her.
Yeah. Neighbors kind of came together and
and
helped her. Yeah.
She was a sweet girl. She didn't have family around, and everybody, they loved her and they really looked out for her, which is so sweet. But they were not so sure about this man and his sister. They actually ran his tag and found out that it was registered to Raymond Fernandez. And remember, he was saying...
He's going by Charles Martin.
Yeah. They didn't really know what to make of that. They didn't even say anything because...
Yeah. And I would part of me thinks, well, that's kind of a nosy neighbor. But no, she was friends with him. So it's more than just being nosy neighbors.
Yeah.
I mean, like if they're doing life together with her...
Yes.
And they see some red flags, they're looking out for her. So that's good. And her parents who gave the blessing, they're in Nebraska. So
they're in Nebraska.
They're way off.
Yeah.
So they're not seeing the everyday stuff.
Right.
They just met him. He was charming. They were happy. But these are the people who are in her everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And so they see some red flags. Yeah.
They even called her father-in-law and they were like, look, we're worried about the baby.
Oh.
But he didn't know what to do. He didn't like it either. But what was he going to do? His son was dead. It was it was a tough situation.
Yeah.
But something happened on Saturday, February 26, 1949. That made Delphine suspicious for the first time. She happened to walk by the bathroom and saw Raymond without his toupee. She hadn't even known that he was bald.
Oh, so he's hiding something already.
Yeah, and these red flags just started going off for her. She suddenly felt really uncomfortable and scared even.
Mm.
It was like the blinders were falling off.
And it makes you want to say, Delphine, listen to that inner voice of red flags.
Yes.
And get away from there as quickly as you can.
Go to your neighbors. Run.
Yeah.
She was just wondering, like, why had he not told me about the scars and the toupee? And is this a disguise? And is Martha really his sister? Like, she was just seeing kind of how weird everything was. And she had just sold her home.
Oh.
What in the world had she just gotten herself and her daughter into? And she was wondering these things out loud.
Oh, well, so herself in danger. Yeah.
Raymond and Martha claimed that she became frantic. That she was crying and yelling and throwing things. I don't know how true that is. So Ray asked Martha if she had any sleeping pills left to keep her quiet.
Mm.
He didn't want her to alert the neighbors. He was, you know, always really hyper nervous about that. Martha said that she was able to persuade Delphine to take phenobarbital and told her that it was for anxiety. I have a hard time believing that. She gave her 14 of
14
them.
14 of them?
That's, yes.
And she took them? Willingly?
That's what she said.
Yeah, I don't believe that either. Nobody's going to do that. I'd be thinking, you're trying to make me overdose.
Remember, now they didn't even realize that they had killed the first lady with an overdose.
That they had put on that bus.
Mm-hmm. And so I don't think at that point that's necessarily what they were thinking would happen.
Well, except Martha was a nurse.
Well, true.
So wouldn't she like have a little bit of knowledge of how the drugs would affect you? I don't know.
Yeah. Somebody said that Charles likened Delphine was kind of a kiss of death for her.
Mm-hmm. I believe it.
As far as Martha was concerned. Delphine was drugged and unconscious in her bed. And later, when Raymond and Martha would confess, they said when she started to come to, Charles decided that she had to be killed because, you know, she would go to authorities.
Right.
Charles puts a pillow over her head. He goes into her nightstand and finds her dead husband's revolver.
Oh, man.
Wraps it up in a blanket. And shoots her in the head.
Mm-mm-mm. And the little girl is in the house.
Yeah. He went to the basement after they killed her. Martha wrapped her body in a blanket. And he went down to the basement and dug a hole. After they put her body in it, they filled the hole up with concrete. Okay, now supposedly this was not premeditated, but they had concrete there. So when they asked him later, like, well, why was the concrete there? He said, well, I was redoing her bathroom, but why are you going to redo a bathroom that you just sold?
Right. You're not going to be even living there.
It's really possible that it was premeditated.
And that's the second one they've done that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they cleaned up and took Raynell to the movies and to get something to eat. Raynell seemed to know that something was wrong, and she just was crying.
How old is Raynell?
She's 2.
Oh.
Oh. So she is crying and crying.
Yeah.
And by the next day, she was constantly crying to the point that Raymond was so paranoid about the neighbors.
Mm.
He was just terrified. So they tried taking her for a drive. He even took her to a pet store and bought her a Cocker Spaniel. But it's so weird. Like, he would do these offhanded.
He's weird.
Yeah. But then the Cocker Spaniel scratched her and made her just scream
more.
And cry even more. And so he took the dog back. He didn't know what to do. Martha said that Raymond had wanted to keep the little girl and take her to Spain with him.
Okay.
With all this money that they had,
mm-hmm.
they were going to go buy a house. But how would they explain her to his family?
Yeah, his wife and kids.
Mm-hmm. Or his parent, you know, anybody. And so Martha said in her confession that the little girl had kept them up screeching all night. Oh, it makes me so mad.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sunday morning, they decided, this is a quote from her, we decided that we were going to put it down with its mother.
Oh, good heavens. It. Calling it it.
Yes.
That's horrible.
That's the same as the lady, the poisoner.
Oh, Earl Dennison.
Earl Dennison, yes. She was the same way. Remember, she
yes.
said she wouldn't have given it poison? It.
Yeah, if she had known she was going to get caught.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, also, I'm thinking, Martha, I'm like, you've got children of your own. Mm-hmm. How can you do this? But at the same time, obviously, she doesn't have that maternal instinct because she
right.
left her children,
right.
abandoned them in a YMCA. I hate this.
Now, Raymond said he could not physically do it. And so he asked Martha to do it. Well, she didn't want to do it either. But finally, she decided that she would.
Whew.
You can fast forward past this part if you want to, because I'm going to give some details that are really terrible.
I might even take my headphones off myself.
Yeah, it's super sad.
Yeah.
So she took Raynell to the basement, undressed her, and forced her head under the water in a big wash basin.
Oh.
She held the baby under the water by using her body weight.
Oh.
But Martha would say, these are her words, the baby struggled so much that I could hardly hold her, so I wrapped it in a blanket and held it all the way under for 15 or 20 minutes.
Oh my goodness, that is incredibly long. I think that is the worst one. I know that's what stuck with me the last time. I don't even know if I remembered that detail, that mm-hmm. quote. I knew that she had killed the child.
Yeah.
But I told you that one had stuck with me for so long. That has to be why. I must have heard some of that.
And then she bashed her in the head.
Oh,
like she wouldn't be dead after being in water for 15 or 20 minutes.
She's a horrible person. I have no sympathy for her.
No.
None. No.
Raymond, they said, and they both say this, that he was upstairs. And that when he knew what she was going to do, but when he heard Raynell cry out, he couldn't stand it. And he ran downstairs and told Martha, let her be, don't let her suffer anymore. But he could see she was underwater. And he said he knew it was too late. She would have died. He was such a nervous wreck that he ran back upstairs like he couldn't stand it. He finally collected his bearings. When it was done, they put her body into her dead father's footlocker and Raymond cemented her in.
That is just beyond words.
Mm-hmm.
These people are pure evil.
Yeah.
Pure, flat out evil. Not that we didn't already know that, but that is like...
That's beyond.
Beyond. Those are like the dregs at the bottom of the cup of evil.
Yeah. Holding a child underwater.
I'm not going to sleep tonight thinking about that.
I guess to get a break from the hard work of killing a baby, they decided to treat themselves to a movie. They could have just left, mind you.
Yeah.
They could have just packed up right then and they could have left. But they were so stingy. They wanted Delphine's stuff in her house so that Martha could furnish her house with.
Greedy and
yes.
just.
Mm-hmm. So when they got back to, you know, her house after eating and catching the show, they very quickly started packing all of her stuff into trunks. They did need to be out of there before the buyers were ready to take over the house and before, of course, neighbors started wanting to know where the mother and daughter were. Those neighbors that Raymond was worried about, they were already suspicious. They had not heard anything from Delphine since Saturday. This was Sunday evening. And through the windows, they could see Raymond and Martha packing up.
Mm.
And they did not see Delphine. So Delphine's her best friend, she called and asked to speak to her and Martha put her off. She's not here right now. And so she just sensed that something was wrong. I really commend this lady. I just wish it had been a little bit sooner.
A little sooner, yeah.
Yeah. So she called Delphine's father-in-law and she's like, look, I just have a bad feeling. And he was like, call the cops.
Yeah.
And so she called the police and she even said, like, I don't want you to think I'm a nosy neighbor. I'm just really concerned about my friend. And they came out there pretty quick. They asked where Delphine and Raynell were. Raymond and Martha, you know, they made up some story about how the mother and daughter were going to visit relatives for a couple of weeks, but the cops were not buying it because all the trunks that they were packing up had Delphine's name in them.
Oh, so if she had gone to visit her family, she would have had those. So
yes.
Okay. So they probably very quickly figured that out because those trunks are sitting out being packed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then there was $4,000 in cash that they found. So they were very suspicious. He told cops that his name was Charles Martin, but he stumbled over his words when they asked why the car was registered to Raymond Fernandez.
Oh, he didn't know that they already knew about that.
Mm-hmm. When they searched the home, and they did search the basement, they noticed wet cement, and that led them to discover Delphine. And then Raynell's body was still warm.
Oh,
yeah, she had been murdered just a few hours.
Oh my goodness!
Before, mm-hmm.
Oh, they were just so close. I mean, obviously. It just makes my heart sick.
They heard from her on Saturday, and that very next day they called.
Yeah, they didn't wait a long time.
No.
But it was just still too late.
A little too late.
Oh, poor Raynell.
Yes. Raymond wiped that arrogant, smug look off of his face, though. This is what he said. You got me dead to rights. I might as well tell everything.
Oh. And does he?
Well, Michigan didn't have a death penalty. And Raymond and Martha were under the impression that if they gave full confessions there, that they couldn't be extradited to New York because New York did have a death penalty. You know, they were told they'd probably only spend about 6 years in prison if they gave full confessions and if they fully cooperated. The sheriff just kind of let them believe what they already believed. He played like he was their friend and he was going to help them any way that they could as long as they were honest with him.
And cooperative. And
yeah. Right. And so Raymond Fernandez started his confession with the words, I'm no ordinary killer.
Oh, that's chilling.
Mm-hmm. He and Martha then confessed to everything. They wrote an 11-page confession letter. The newspapers exploded with headlines about the Lonely Hearts Killers.
Sure.
The sheriff even allowed reporters into the station as they were giving their confessions because he said they were not going to come back later and say that a confession was beat out of them.
I love this police work that's being done mm-hmm. here because they searched that basement.
Yes.
They didn't take no for an answer, or they didn't accept that lie that they're packing up themselves and they're gone. Like, they saw those trunks. They're going along with them and letting them think that they're going to get away with something. And they're covering their hide. I love it. These police officers are doing an awesome job.
So impressed with them.
Yeah.
But anyway, these reporters were especially brutal to Martha. She was described in newspapers as a fat paramour.
Oh, mercy.
Roly-poly.
Oh, wow.
The 200-pound murderess.
And 200 pounds really doesn't sound like a lot.
I know. I mean, thinking, golly.
Yeah.
I know. I was not that long ago, 200 pounds. Unattractive, simpering. Fat Martha, Big Martha. I was reading these newspaper articles. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
Mountainous.
My goodness.
250-pound figure of wrath.
I don't agree with fat shaming at all.
Right.
But honestly, I don't have any sympathy for her. If that hurts her feelings, well, so be it. Okay, Martha, good for you.
That's exactly my thought. Every other thing I had heard about this, they really were very sympathetic to Martha. I'm very sympathetic to her victims.
Yeah, I don't care about her feelings at this point.
Exactly. But things were about to get even worse for Martha and for Raymond. Because that sheriff in Michigan had no plans of honoring that commitment he'd made to them about, you know, them getting out of prison in 6 years, really.
Yeah.
He just wanted a confession. This was an opportunity of a lifetime for him, a career-defining moment. And I do believe it was good police work. I don't think he just did it for that. But this was probably a big deal for their little town.
I'm sure.
So he played good cop. He did what he had to do, and it worked. But he, along with most of the U.S., wanted those two to pay with their lives.
Absolutely.
But if they were going to face the death penalty, it would not happen for at least 10 years because they would have to spend a minimum of 10 years in Michigan for the murder of Delphine mm-hmm. and Raynell, and there was no death penalty there.
Okay.
Now, after that, they could be extradited to New York, and then they would go on trial there, and it would be decided. But the thing is in 10 years, a lot of time passes. There's not that fiery, you know, where everybody just wants justice.
Well, your feelings have a chance to, you know, to calm back down and subside, and you're not seeing it in the media, so it's not first and foremost in your mind, and you're not feeling as passionate about it.
Yes.
But I'm going to tell you, I have listened to a ton of true crime stories, and there is never anybody I would like to hear get the death penalty more than Martha. Right now, I'm just like, I hope she gets the death penalty.
Yeah, and that's what these guys were thinking. They're like, 10 years later, is that even going to really happen? So the New York governor and Michigan prosecutors, they spent days on the phone negotiating. And so it came as a great big surprise when on March 8th, 1949, Michigan waived charges for the murder of Delphine and Raynell in order to allow the couple to immediately be extradited to New York.
Oh, hallelujah.
Yes. So they were going to New York to face charges for the murder of Janet Faye.
Okay. So again, it's a strategic move to get them the justice that the victims deserve. And the perpetrators deserve consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they have to strategically make things happen, then great.
That's what they're going to do.
Good.
Then I saw some articles that said, look, if the people of Michigan want them to receive the death penalty, and they did, why don't we have a death penalty?
Well, that's a good
why
point.
Why are we having to send them somewhere else for them to get justice?
I wonder if they ever voted it back in.
I'm not sure.
I'll have to look up
But that was interesting to me. The reason they did that was solely because New York had a death penalty.
Yes.
But there's a trial now.
Yeah.
And it's only the trial for Janet Faye. So keep that in mind.
Oh.
So out of six known victims, they would only ever be tried for the murder of Janet Faye. Here are, you know, quotes from some articles, just so you get the idea of the sentiments about especially Martha. The Carrier Post, June 29th, 1949, Fat Martha shrieks at witness. The Gallatin Inquirer, June 29th, Fat Martha Beck on trial with her paramour for the murder of a trusting widow. The Brooklyn Daily Eagle, the bald gold-tooth mail order Romeo and his fat mistress on trial for their lives. Golly.
Well, we don't see headlines like that today.
No.
So that one.
You know, these are just a few mild ones among many. The trial was moved to the Bronx. In Long Island, they were not going to get a fair trial. This trial lasted from June 28th to August 18th. That's a long time.
Yeah.
Beck and Fernandez were given the same lawyer, which honestly shouldn't have happened because that's a conflict of interest.
Right, because they may actually testify against each other.
Yeah, and it's impossible to adequately defend both of them at the same time. But New York did not really care because that trial was really just a formality.
Yeah.
They were already guilty as far as everybody else was concerned. Now, Martha Beck was ridiculed in newspapers about her looks, the way she dressed, how unemotional and mean she looked. And she would like yell out at people in court. She was something. Once when Raymond was led into the court, Martha quickly got away from whoever was holding her and she flung her arms around him and kissed him on the mouth, leaving like red lipstick and a smile. People were fascinated with those two and they did play a part.
I think they probably enjoyed that attention.
I do too.
Especially, I mean, we've talked about how he was so arrogant. And obviously, she's just crazy.
Yeah. Okay, so that happened during the summer when there was a major heat wave in New York City. 800 people died there.
Oh, wow.
From heat. But still, they were like waiting out to see if they could get into the courtroom or to just kind of hear word about what was going on. So that's how desperate people were.
They would stand out in the heat just to try to get in and see or hear this.
Right.
Yeah.
And they were given a lot of salacious sexual details.
In the court.
About their relationship. Some women got up and left.
Oh, man.
So others wouldn't give up their seat even to take lunch because they wanted to
They didn't want to miss. Like, yeah.
Right. So anyway, now remember how I told you before, Raymond had confessed to everything in Michigan, right?
Mm-hmm.
He and Martha wrote this 11-page confession letter. Martha had admitted Then in a blind fit of rage, she bashed Janet's head in with that hammer. And then Fernandez confessed that after Martha had hit her in the head, he tried strangling her with the scarf, right? Well, he actually said she wasn't dying. And so that's when he took the hammer, twisted it, made the garret, turning it around and around till she was strangled to death. They even said in that confession that her false teeth had came out and that they had disposed of them so that she couldn't be identified if they found the body. So everyone kind of assumed that this was going to be an open and shut case. Their defense figured that the only hope that these two had of not getting the chair was if they could convince the jury that Fernandez did not kill her and that Beck did, but she was temporarily insane.
Because it was like a crime of passion.
Right.
Darlene, if you tell me that they get away with this, I'm not going to be happy.
Raymond and the defense were willing to throw Martha under the bus, and that's really what they set out to do. And Martha was willing to do just about anything for Raymond.
Wow.
So Raymond was now saying that he only made that confession because he believed that there was only 6 years at stake here. And he was thinking, I'm in trouble anyway for all the fraud and all the other things that he had done. So he was thinking, I'll just confess. He said he didn't feel like Martha could survive in prison that long. And he was in love with her. And that's why he confessed. He said that the room was full of people, that he was sleep deprived, you know, when he made that confession. And he didn't know if he was coming or going. He claimed that what really happened was after he discovered that Martha hit Janet over the head and shook Martha back into reality. So they admit that part. When Martha kind of came to her senses, she said, oh my goodness, what have I done? And he said that Martha then bent down to check Janet's pulse, but that she was already gone. So the prosecution asked, well, why did you put the scarf around her neck? He claimed that he only used it as a tourniquet to stop the profuse bleeding. He said that she was bleeding all over the place, so he did use the scarf, but not to kill her. She was already dead. When the prosecution got loud, Martha stood up and yelled, Mr. Fernandez is not hard of hearing. And then Martha testified. It was her turn. This is when she also brought up all the childhood abuse claims involving her older brother and her mom. It's interesting that Martha begged her mom not to come to trial that day.
Oh my goodness, like maybe she made all that up.
When her mom came anyway against her wishes, she would not let her come in the room and sit in the trial.
Okay, I'm sorry. Gotta stop here. She literally could have made that up for that trial. That's when she came forward with that to garner sympathy and all of that because she's already obviously a liar.
Right.
I mean, she's a
pathological liar for sure.
Exactly. And she is not a credible person. Mm-mm. Now, it's not saying that didn't happen and didn't add to her mental issues, whatever she's got going on or her whatever. But now we don't know because you're not credible.
Right. So I think Martha did have a hard life. Probably she was made fun of by her peers. Obviously, she was rejected by these men. I think her mom was doting and controlling. But the beatings and the sexual abuse allegations, I just don't know. Her mom and her brother seemed to genuinely love her. They both stood by her. They visited her in prison. They both acted like they just could not believe that she was guilty of this. And if she did, they didn't think she could have possibly acted of her own accord. It does raise the question.
It does raise the question.
This is direct quotes from her mom. When it was suggested, you know, that she not worry.
Yeah, they're trying to comfort her.
Yeah. She stared and said, don't tell a mother not to worry. She's my little girl. And you can't imagine how it hurts when some of the papers come out and say things about her. One even called her fat. She's got the prettiest eyes. That isn't true at all. She's always been a good little girl. That just doesn't sound like somebody who
ridiculed her growing up and told her she was ugly and stuff. If she's upset that they've called her daughter that,
not really
making me want to believe Martha that much.
Exactly. And her brother was actually a police officer there in Pensacola. That doesn't mean anything. But I know that he was on her visitors list.
Yeah.
You know, when she was in prison and he went to see her.
Yeah.
And her family stuck beside her. So I just don't know.
Yeah.
Martha also said since she and Raymond had been together, she had attempted suicide 4 or 5 times over her jealousy, and she doubled down on the claim that she did not remember the actual murder. She swore that it was the truth and that she wasn't lying to protect Raymond. A psychiatrist did declare her mentally unsound and said if she did do the killing, she probably had no memory of it. But that was a defense psychiatrist.
Yeah, they probably hired that one.
Her defense attorney said that Beck had killed Janet in a fit of insane rage brought on by jealousy and tried his best to prove that Fernandez had no part in the crime other than conning Janet and covering up for her murder. But the prosecution read from that original confession to the jury, and it was damning. And so after deliberating for 12 and a half hours, the jury convicted Martha Beck and Raymond Fernandez of first-degree murder, and the death sentence was mandatory.
Oh, I am so, so glad that's what you said. I was really stressing that they were going to get out on some kind of insanity plea or something.
So I do think everyone wanted to see Martha get emotional, but she kept her composure. She looked unbothered by the whole thing. If anything, she looked mad.
Is that like a sociopathic type?
Maybe. They were transferred to Sing Sing, and they did try to take advantage of that appeals process. Here's a quote from an article in the Chicago Tribune from August 19th, 1949. Swarthy Raymond Fernandez and his fat lover, Martha Beck, waited in their cells to begin on Monday the attempts to save their own skin, unquote. The New York State Court of Appeals denied them a new trial. The governor, Thomas Dewey, turned down a plea for clemency.
Good.
The U.S. Supreme Court refused to review the case. All of this took about 2 years, so they did add some time on, and they sat on death row during that time. Sometimes they were in love with each other, and they would, you know, send each other these extravagant love letters. Other times, they were sending each other hate mail back and forth. It was something. And I doubt Martha knew the entire time he was writing several other women, including his wife in Spain.
Okay.
Yes. So, and I bet he wished he'd have kept his behind in Spain with his family.
I bet he does.
The Birmingham News on March 7th, 1951. And the Lonely Hearts Killers had their last hour in the sun today. And then March 8th, 1951, the Lonely Hearts Killers were set to die. Just before his time, Martha sent one last note professing her love. Raymond Fernandez's last words were, "The news brought to me that Martha loves me is the best I've had in years. I'm ready to die, so tonight I'll die like a man."
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And Beck's last statement before she was executed was, "What does it matter who is to blame? My story is a love story, but only those tortured with love can understand what I mean. I was pictured as a fat, unfeeling woman. I'm not unfeeling, stupid, or moronic. In the history of the world, how many crimes have been attributed to love?"
She said she's not unfeeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's unfeeling, except when it comes to her own self.
Yes.
And her love for Raymond. But
right.
She's unfeeling. I'm sorry, anybody that can do that to a baby is unfeeling. Like, she wants it to be this love story. I'm sorry, but no, it's not a love story.
No.
It's a horror story.
I'd like to thank y'all so much for listening and let you know we really do appreciate your support. And I want to remind you to go ahead and light up all 5 of those stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And if you're on Apple, you can go ahead and leave us a quick review. And you can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And you can leave questions and comments at hardtimesandtruecrimes.com. Now, the Google says that every year, hundreds of people go missing in our national parks and forests, and oftentimes wind up miles away, confused and naked. If you'd like to guarantee that this never happens to you, subscribe and follow to Hard Times and True Crimes, and tell everyone that you know to come check us out. Till next time, goodbye.
Is it a sin? Is it a crime? Loving you, dear, like I do. If it's a crime, then I'm guilty. Guilty of loving you. Maybe I'm wrong.